Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Oklahomans don't need to be reminded that with natural disasters, it's not a matter of if they will occur, but when, and how best to be prepared to survive and mitigate their effect. And our state has lots of threats, tornadoes, obviously, but also flooding, wildfires, even seismic activity these days. My guest today says that natural disasters are inevitable, but the human catastrophes which often accompany them are not. Dr. Lucy Jones was a seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey for 33 years and led the development of the first major American earthquake drill, the Great Shakeout, all along the coast of California. She served as the science advisor for risk reduction and has advised communities throughout California on how to make their citizens more disaster resilient and prepared for major earthquakes. Today, she is a research associate at Caltech and the author of The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. In it, she describes major natural disasters that became human catastrophes throughout history, some very familiar, others far less so, and the lessons learned from each of these events, as well as personal advice on resilience. Educate yourself. Don't assume government will handle a natural disaster, and especially expand your definition of preparedness to preparing to respond. Dr. Lucy Jones joins me today to talk about her book, The Big Ones, here on Studio Tulsa. Dr. Jones, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
In the aftermath of the Sumatran tsunami and Hurricane Katrina, we heard an awful lot of talk and thought put into resiliency, the idea that natural disasters are going to happen, so it's best to have planning, reaction, and mitigation plans in place. Certainly your work at United States Geological Survey was directly involved in building resiliency. I want to ask you before we talk about the book, how would you say we're doing overall in the United States?
Much better than we were, with much left to be done. How about that? There are some aspects that I'm seeing a shift in the social consciousness. The idea of resilience has finally become upfront for a lot of people. And an important part of that is not just, you know, be ready to respond, but actually how can we live with on a long term, prevent the damage. And I see a lot more focus on that. But it's a beginning of the process with a lot that still needs to be physically done to handle this.
And of course, that physical process, if you're talking about Southern California and the San Andreas Fault, you're talking decades, aren't you?
Oh, without question. I mean, when we look at what the problems are here, one of the biggest issues is that our water pipes tend to break in earthquakes. Water pipes are old. Nobody wants to pay for them. Whoever sees them. And, you know, that's probably decades, if not a century, to really try to upgrade the status of the water system.
Of course, as you write in the book, it says, you know, not only do water lines break, so do gas lines, and gas lines cause fires, and you need water to put out fires.
Right. When we did this big analysis of a San Andreas earthquake, we ended up concluding that damage to the water system was responsible for the majority of the losses, first because of fires that can't be fought, and then businesses that can't reopen. You know, you can't have a beauty salon or a restaurant or most manufacturing without water. And if we lose water for 6 months, which is one of the estimates of how long it would take to get our water pipes replaced, we have a lot of businesses that will just disappear in that time.
Yeah. As you look around various parts of the country today, you can still see there's still a lot of work to do when you look at something like Puerto Rico and Hurricane Maria, where electricity is still not reliable. The rebuilding from that storm, and actually it was two storms, Irma and Maria, but mainly Maria, you see that we still have a long way in resiliency planning and work.
Well, I think actually what's happened to Puerto Rico, I think, is a very good object lesson on a number of fronts. One is that systems fail where they are already weak. And if you haven't maintained your infrastructure, you're going to have much more problems. That said, it isn't all Puerto Rico's fault.
No.
You know, both Irma and Maria hit the island. And Maria, the eye of the storm ran right down the center of the island. By comparison, Florida with Hurricane Irma, the eye pretty much stayed offshore to the west, and everybody experienced the hurricane, but it wasn't really strong winds. Whereas in Puerto Rico, they got the strongest winds, you know, through the full length of the island. And so that idea that I think I've been in a big event, you probably haven't. You know, you were probably farther away from the earthquake's fault and therefore didn't get as much shaking, or you were really on the edges of the hurricane and you didn't get the full force of the winds. And we tend to fool ourselves and not recognizing those differences of how much proximity matters. But of course, then the third lesson I think we need to learn from what's happened in Puerto Rico is to understand how important the recovery process is. And we really need to share as a country in the needs of the region. The idea that we haven't been really getting in there and getting them back quickly, we are creating long-term, decades-long suffering for the people that are going through this.
And it's still, you know, electricity is still, you know, I guess the power's mainly back on, but it's still, at this point, it's still sketchy at times. And this is what? They're starting hurricane season here within a couple of weeks.
Yeah, we've gone more like six, you know, 8 months since the hurricane, and here we are seeing these sort of problems. And there's the suffering they're going through right now. But if you've gone 6 months without power, there's a lot of small businesses that no longer exist. And you build in the problems. It isn't just at the moment. And I think we don't do enough to look at how these interplayed systems create long-term economic consequences.
That actual storm actually brings up one of the unfortunate themes of your book, is that how people react to a major disaster. There's also this element of socioeconomic conditions. You look at what happened in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, which is, again, a combination of events. You're very specific in saying there was a combination of events. The Mississippi flood of 1927 and several other events in which people of low socioeconomic means are not treated in the same way others are treated in the aftermath of a disaster.
Again, two big issues here. One is the fact that systems fail where they're already weak, so impoverished areas suffer more. And this isn't an oddity of a particular disaster. Every disaster, the poor suffer more than the rich. And even if they have as much damage, the rich have more resources to cope with it and move on, and you don't get the compounding problems. But then there's another issue as well, that we as human beings are very afraid of the randomness that disasters take. Even the word disaster itself comes from the Latin disaster, ill-starred, reflecting our belief that it's, you know, somehow fate. There's, you know, that there's got to be an explanation for that randomness. And we used to blame it on the gods, or if you were in Asia, it was a yin-yang balance. Every human culture has come up for reasons for why a disaster strikes at a particular time. And as our scientific understanding of the disasters has increased and started removing these emotional props of why they happen, we still want to find that pattern. And what, unfortunately, is to see the degree to which we are turning to blaming the victim. We have to find a reason that says it won't happen to me. So if it was the victim's fault, if they made a bunch of really stupid choices, then I can think that I can protect myself from it. I saw it most clearly, I think, in looking at Hurricane Katrina, at which this whole narrative of how awful these people must be and the breakdown of social order, and it didn't say they deserved this, but it somehow helped us keep thinking it wouldn't happen to us. And, you know, with time, those narratives just haven't played out. It wasn't a huge breakdown in social order. It was desperate people trying to live. But, we, you know, that whole thing of being able to see it as the victim's fault is an emotional crutch for the rest of us to think it won't happen to us.
And that breakdown of social order thought is still prevalent there, even though it has been disputed and really rebutted in many cases. A lot of the looting was police directed to tell residents to get stuff you need to get so you can be safe. There's been a lot of reporting and a lot of reports made by government agencies that have shown that social disorder really was overblown, and fears because of it weren't overblown.
Right. And that's, you know, I did a lot of research to write this book, and I wanted to be sure about what I could really say happened or not happened. And most of the early reports didn't hold up. But there were a lot of, because of the fear, there were a lot of issues of either African-American residents or mixed-race groups trying to get out of New Orleans and literally being forced back into the city at gunpoint by people on the outside who were afraid of them. But it's, you know, New Orleans isn't the only situation. And we had the 1927 floods in Mississippi that were also egregious impacts on African-American victims. But it's also not unique to America. We've seen it in other disasters where, you know, in Japan, people turned on Korean neighbors. I think it ties into this deep human need to find someone or something to blame. And if you're, you know, gods have been taken away from you, you turn to the people around you.
In your book, The Big Ones, you look at a number of disasters, some familiar, some very unfamiliar, and how they've affected us, and some of the painful lessons that sometimes we have to relearn over history. What was your reason for writing it?
Well, you know, I spent over 30 years as a seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey here in Southern California. And in that time, I was often called upon to answer news media requests or government requests. What happened? What was this earthquake? How do I understand it? And so I got a lot of experience of talking to people about disasters and came to the understanding that people were not coming to me because of the science that I thought was so interesting. People were looking for reassurance, dealing with irrational fears, turning to science as a way to calm the fears and understand what was going on. And that understanding was something I wanted to share. And the more I looked into it, the more I saw how defining our fear of randomness is to our approach to disasters. And so that was why I started the book. The process of writing it, I feel like I learned a lot by really looking at the variety of disasters. I had worked with other disaster scientists, especially in the last decade at the USGS, but, you know, got to dig in more detail. And also, I had come to understand how much people need stories. We don't learn or make decisions out of rational assessments in general. People make decisions to act because they have an emotional connection to the problem. So I recognized I needed to find stories by which to convey these ideas, and therefore came up with this idea of really trying to tell the stories of historic disasters, and found that both interesting and learning, you know, learning more myself, but also a good vehicle for sharing the information.
You would think in natural disasters as desperate as volcanic eruptions, floods of river basins, or earthquakes or tsunamis, which you all talk about in the book, are there any common themes that sort of are common to all of these natural disasters?
Most of the human side is shared in that one of the things is, you know, what is a big one? We have scientific answers that are based on, you know, the magnitude of the earthquake or the size, you know, the amount of material ejected by the volcano or whatever. But when people are asking us that question, it really is about what's happened to me. What is it that's happening to society? And the physical part is only one piece of that. And so I came to this understanding that you could say, you know, the big ones, the most catastrophic disasters are the ones that literally disrupt society. And that's, you know, that's what happens to the human beings rather than the physical events. Some of the physical things are also shared in that the very biggest disasters affect a much larger area than the smaller ones. And so that difference between disaster and catastrophe is not so much what happens to one individual. It's a disaster if your own house is destroyed, but it's a catastrophe when so many houses are destroyed that society is struggling to function. And the other thing is that those very biggest ones on all of the disasters happen much, much more rarely than the small ones. Almost by definition, whatever disaster happens, you know, on decadal sort of scales, your community has figured out how to deal with them. It's the ones that only happen every 100 years or 1,000 years or more that are the ones that are, you know, become really catastrophic. And just physically, on all of the disasters, the biggest ones happen much less frequently than the smaller ones.
Yeah. You were writing about Fukushima, and there the disaster preparations were as good as they thought they could make them. It's just that if you create a seawall that's 30 feet and all of a sudden you have a 100-foot wall of water, that's completely inadequate to the task.
Well, and here's one of the challenges, especially as a scientist, you know, as a seismologist, one of our jobs is to try and figure out what are the, you know, what's the earthquake going to be like? What is it that you should be expecting? We can't tell the time because that is fundamentally a random occurrence. But we do know what. It's spatially predictable. We can recognize the faults and all of these things. But we have uncertainty. And as scientists, we spend lots of time talking to uncertainty. When we talk to non-specialists, they often want an answer rather than, you know, the range or whatever, or understanding to what degree it's a limit. And what do you do when you say, you know, the chances are it's going to be this size, but there's a 1% chance it could be much, much bigger? Well, as scientists, as engineers, we work with the one that it's most likely to be, but sometimes it's different. And I think one of the things we need to do, instead of saying, what's it likely going to be and build for that, I think we should step back and say, what is completely unacceptable? What is a result that we cannot bear to have? And what do we need to do to make sure it doesn't, whatever the range of possible things comes in? And, you know, when you say nuclear power plants, failing the nuclear power plant is a really big one. Maybe you just use a different approach and say, what is the biggest you could ever possibly imagine? And don't say this is the most likely. Say what's possible and how do we avoid that?
My guest today is Dr. Lucy Jones, a research associate at Caltech, and she was a seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey for 33 years and was a science advisor for risk reduction while there. She developed the first major American earthquake drill, the Great Shakeout, which continues to this day. It will be in October coming up in 2018. And she's the author of The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us. It's published by Doubleday. Your book examines a variety of major disasters, looking at what we can learn from the event. Some are very familiar. We mentioned the Fukushima earthquake and tsunami, Hurricane Katrina. I also mentioned the Mississippi floods of 1927. Others are very much not in anybody's memory. You said, you know, what if you asked a Californian what was the greatest natural disaster in the state history, most people would say one of the more recent earthquakes. You say actually the most devastating event is probably something very few people have ever heard of, and that's the California Great Flood.
It surprised me when I first heard about it. I'm a fourth-generation Southern Californian, but my family came here in the 1870s, and the flood was in 1861-62. But it was such a devastating event, it literally bankrupted the state. It destroyed one-third of the taxable land. It turned the Central Valley of California into a 300-mile-long lake.
Wow.
Destroyed many cities. They're just completely gone. And yet most Californians don't even know about it. And part of it is that 150 years is a long time ago, and especially in a more transient civilization such as America has been, most of us don't have family that were around at the time. But there's also an issue that we just don't think that rain is that dangerous a phenomenon. In fact, across the United States, floods have done as much damage and killed as many people as any of the other major disasters. But who's afraid of the rain? Because it happens all the time, we just have this feeling that it's not as that bad. And of course, you can see it, you know, you see it coming, you see the water, you get predictions. That all makes it less frightening.
Unfortunately, here in Oklahoma, we are all too well aware of the damage floods can do. Flooding is, you know, if not an every year occurrence, it's a once in every 5 to 10 year occurrences, and every once in a while, huge floods.
Well, and you've got the same issue. You know, you think you know how to handle floods because you've got them every 5 or 10 years, but the one that's going to, you know, the 500-year flood, which will happen at some point, is going to be so much worse. People are going to be surprised. I've lived here for fill in the blank. I've never seen anything like this. As though that meant it couldn't happen. But and that's part of the earth scientist dilemma from our point of view. These are absolutely inevitable. And 500 years, yeah, that's part of natural variability. But, of course, it's not the way most people think about it.
When I was learning about some of these disasters, the one that really surprised me, and it's probably the area in which we're probably least prepared, but it's also probably the least likely in all probability, and that would be a volcano. We don't think about volcanoes. But you write that they're the greatest potential for massive physical disruption around, and one most of us have never heard of, was the worst disaster perhaps in history, the Laki eruption in Iceland in 1783?
Right, yeah. I mean, most people weren't aware that Iceland existed in 1783. And a massive eruption that almost destroyed the country. That country had about 50,000 people. They lost over one-fifth of the population. Not that the lava, you know, hit them and burned them up, but rather that it produced so many poison gases, it poisoned the food supply. We're hearing about this in Kilauea right now, yeah. That's the, you know, the poisonous gases that come out with it are a significant issue. The way Kilauea is happening, the lava's flowing, mostly the gases are staying close to the ground and eventually dissipate. In the Laki eruption, it was explosive. The gases got up high in the atmosphere, traveled over to Europe, and they estimate 23,000 people died just in the UK alone that summer from the poisonous gases. Now, they didn't realize at the time it was connected to the volcano. They just knew that workers that were going out and, you know, working in the fields, bringing in the crops, were collapsing and dying.
Wow. And I guess you said that the total death toll is estimated to be maybe as much as millions?
Yes. So you've got this direct poisoning in Europe, 50,000, 100,000 people. Then you've got the famine, or the huge cold that came in, because particles also got up into the stratosphere and blocked sunlight and literally cooled the earth. It was a very big effect that winter in Europe. It led to a famine. That famine actually was part of the contribution to the French Revolution. But it also spread around the world, cooling the continents, which disrupted the monsoonal flows, which is the difference between the continents heat up in the summer and the cooler ocean, you know, air gets pulled into the continent and brings the rains. When that didn't happen, the Nile didn't flood. There's a famine that killed 600,000 people in Egypt. There was a famine that killed 11 million people in India. Now, it's not, you know, there's considered to be some other mitigating factors, so it's not solely attributed to the volcano. But it's got to be in the millions that died in that event, which is the most from any event in human history. And it's because of that ability to change the atmosphere.
Was this what you would call a super volcano?
Not particularly.
No, it wasn't.
Uh-huh. Okay, so they have this VEI, Volcano Explosivity Index, with a 1 to 8, and it was a 6 on that scale. So It wasn't as big as Krakatoa. One of the reasons it had such a big impact is because Iceland being up near the pole, the stratosphere is much closer. It's the lower atmosphere is thinner
right.
at the poles than it is at the equator. So volcanoes like Krakatoa or Pinatubo have to push their gases up like 12 kilometers into the air, whereas only 8 above Iceland. So a much larger percentage of these gases got into the stratosphere, and that's important because it's dry and the gases can maintain for much longer up there. And therefore, it had a bigger global impact.
Of course, Krakatoa also was a year without a summer event, or a lot of places around the world as well.
Exactly, and I think we just by the mid 19th century, compared to the mid the 18th century,
right.
We had a better ability to compensate and use transportation to bring in alternate food supplies and such things. I think the big lesson for human beings, though, as we listen to this, is material in the atmosphere has a huge consequence.
Yes,
and
it does.
You can't guess what I'm talking about, right? And of course, the carbon dioxide that we're putting out traps infrared and therefore keeps heat in, whereas the sulfates that got into the stratosphere, one thing they were in the they were blocking the ultraviolet, and that was keeping the heat out. Volcanoes actually also produce carbon dioxide, but it's a fraction of what the human beings are producing every year.
Absolutely. In our last couple of minutes, I wanted to mention, here in Oklahoma, we have human-induced earthquakes.
Right.
Now, those are not as big as the ones you're talking about in your book, where you're having faults that are 100 miles long that are sliding 200 feet, 300 right. feet in some of these huge earthquakes. But I think of also tornadoes. And this is probably one of our biggest success stories in a resiliency in action. Everything from early warning to immediate warning to aftermath and safe rooms, new technology and roofing that helps mitigate some of the damage from a tornado. To me, this is one of the bigger success stories. Now, we're not talking about huge scale disasters, but still, if a tornado's in your neighborhood, it's a disaster.
Oh, yeah. And I actually considered trying to do a chapter on Joplin. I ended up not including it. But tornadoes, in general, because they spend, what's a maximum on the ground might be like 30 minutes, there is a physical limit to how much damage they can do because of that. And so it doesn't have quite that scaling feature, but they have a bigger life safety issue. And how much has been done on that is truly one of our huge successes in terms of those warning systems, because tornadoes have historically killed a lot more people than earthquakes have in the United States.
Yeah.
But I think that also the starting to move to some of these building code issues and roofing issues to try and actually, to the degree it can happen, prevent the losses, that's the part that's going to really give us resilience. We want to save lives, but we also want to not have a community completely destroyed and needing to rebuild from the ground up.
Well, let me ask you one last question. You've been involved with the Great Shakeout, and certainly you document some of your discussions with political leaders in California during your time at the USGS and urging them to take this seriously. How prepared are we for a big one in Southern California? Or by contrast to the other fault that caused such a huge earthquake once upon a time, the New Madrid along the central part of the country, which, of course, that was a huge earthquake in 1811, 1812, I think.
Right, yeah. I would much rather be in an earthquake in California than in Missouri or Tennessee. because we have done a lot about our building codes, and that makes a huge difference. Of course, it's easier to get these through when you have regular earthquakes to remind you of why it's necessary. There's a lot more that still needs to be done, but I am incredibly encouraged by the shift in the public discussion over the last decade here in California. We are seeing many communities moving forward with retrofitting ordinances. I spoke at a city council, Oxnard. It's one of the top 20 cities in California, but of course not many people have heard of it outside of the region, 200,000 people. And they're making a commitment to go after some of their known bad buildings. And we're seeing it in city after city over the last decade. So we are getting a shift in attitude, which is incredibly encouraging. We need to keep it up, and there's a lot of work that still needs to be done.
All right. The name of the book is The Big Ones. Very fascinating look at major natural disasters around the world over the last couple of hundred years, going back, I guess, to Vesuvius and Pompeii. That's the first story. It's a very interesting book. Dr. Jones, Lucy Jones, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Dr. Lucy Jones is a seismologist and research associate at Caltech and the author of The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us. It's published by Doubleday. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.